You're listening to The Lodestar, the supply chain and logistics industry's leading source of insight. This podcast was created and produced by MK and Associates and your host, Mike King.
We're back and we're rip-roaring today through the Baltimore blame game, the decline and fall of the Port of Hong Kong. We've got rates and contract negotiation updates, the latest from the Red Sea, and we're talking detention and demurrage. Not least because a certain podcast has just been cited in a complaint before the US Federal Maritime Commission. What a crazy shipping world it is. I'm joined today by the Lodestar's Gavin Van Moor, Zenitor Air Freight Chief Neil van der Waal, and the luminescent forwarding force that is the North American Head of Ocean Freight at Remus Logistics. It's Stephanie Loomis.
I do think there are a lot of dynamics right now driving this, and there will be a likelihood of an early peak season for sure. I mean, you've got longer transit times around Africa. You've got just the general need for restocking, which is great for the industry. You've got the Baltimore blow to the East Coast. You've got the continual Panama Canal drought and obviously the ILA labor situation. And I do think there is a big fear of the possibility that Trump could win and that he would put these giant tariffs in place that would be disastrous.
Hello, everybody. I'm Mike King. Welcome to the Lodestar podcast. Housework first. You can follow this podcast wherever you'd like to listen. You can also subscribe to receive it direct to your inbox at lodestar.com, where you'll find all the best supply chain journalism. Joining us later, we'll have the latest on air freight rates when we're joined by Zenitor Chief Air Freight Officer Neil van der Waal. But first, let's get into some of the big stories of the day with a couple of people who know a bit about the world of shipping and logistics. First up, it's the Lodestar's very own Managing Editor, Gavin van Moor. How are you doing, Gav?
I'm doing very well, Mike. Thank you very much for having me on once again.
You're always welcome. And next, we have an old friend of the Lodestar podcast and a three-decade ocean freight veteran whose career has taken in senior roles at Kuehne & Nagel, DHL Global Forwarding and DB Schenker. She's now at Remus Logistics as head of ocean freight for North America. Steph Loomis, welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Always fun to be here.
Steph, some good news first. Remus is now the 14th largest 3PL globally. I bet not many of our listeners knew that. Congratulations in order, I guess.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was happy to see that JOC article with us as one of the few growing forwarders in 2023. We really did have a very good year. I mean, part of it is North America can only go up because of our size. But overall, Remus is extremely hyper-focused on growth right now. We're all about volume and really getting aggressive on our pricing and rates. So we're hoping to keep going in the right direction.
Did we say JOC story there? How dare you? How dare you?
I'm so sorry.
So that's okay. Well done, Remus. Okay, first, we'll have to turn to Baltimore, won't we? The Dolly, which was owned by Great Ocean Private and chartered to Maersk, smashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge on 28th of March, closing the port of Baltimore, stranding a lot of cargo and causing the tragic deaths of six people. The ship was on its way to China via Colombo in Sri Lanka. It wasn't full, and we believe it was probably carrying a fair few empties plus some exports. So this wasn't an import logistics problem, as was mistakenly reported in by quite a few commentators. Baltimore is closed, though, and it's the fifth largest US East Coast container port, as well as a bigger player in the auto trade. Steph, did you have many customers caught up in this, or have you been speaking to people needing help with finding alternative shipping arrangements or advice on how to manage the port closure?
Yeah, we were fortunate enough not to have any boxes on the Dolly. But of course, we've got customers that need, you know, that are dealing with diversions and needing to move boxes in a way they haven't before. So we set up a control tower in our New Jersey office that is handling most of those, either the longer drays, the transloading, hot shots, things like that.
And there was a tightening of US truck markets in that area in late March, early April. Has that settled down now?
Well, I mean, obviously in Baltimore, this is more than likely going to get even tighter because the capacity is going to get stretched. So there are going to be longer journeys from either New York or Norfolk or even, you know, possibly other ports to back to the Baltimore area. So I'd say, you know, overall, coming out of the trough that we were in 2023 for trucking, I think things are looking good for it to be a much better year for the truckers, for sure.
Okay, thanks, Steph. Gav, you've been on point on this story for the Loadstar. Even though, as I said, Baltimore isn't a major container port in the general scheme of things, this has happened when East Coast ports are already quite pushed for capacity. Which carriers have been most impacted?
Okay, well, I'm going on S&P Global's data that was passed to me a few days ago on this. So port handle 1.1 million TEU in 2023 for the 12 months up to the end of February 2024. The top three carriers for those volumes were MSC at 31.5%, and Maersk 21.8%, and Zim at 19.8%. So collectively, nearly 60%, sort of around two-thirds of the port's container traffic is controlled by those three carriers, which cooperate on services, right? I mean, in fact, the TP12 stroke Empire, as it's marketed by MSC, was an Asia-US East Coast service that Zim chartered slots on. And that was the service that the Dolly was employed upon. Yeah, I mean, I think like Stephanie said, there's not a huge amount of supply chain pressure that we placed on the US East Coast by this incident itself. Although it has occurred to me, of course, that the role that Baltimore would have played as a pressure release valve should anything happen elsewhere on the East Coast.
Yes.
You know, Baltimore has got, it's not the biggest port, but it is, interestingly, it is the deepest port on the US East Coast. So the thing about Baltimore is it can handle any vessel that might be calling on the entire range. So if something happens elsewhere, that's when you might see a really severe impact from the bridge elision, as it's called.
I've got Drury on the next podcast, and I had a little pre-interview chat with them, and they said the capacity on the East Coast, some of those Northeast Coast ports, is already relatively tight. If you look at how long ships are waiting to dock. Steph, are you seeing any sign of that at the moment?
I mean, a little bit. I mean, obviously you've got, this is just another, you know, unfortunate blow to the East Coast ports with everything going on from, you know, the longer transit times around Africa, the Panama Canal drought. So it's certainly not good news for the East Coast overall. And I would agree with Gavin. I think that if this would have been a much bigger issue, should it have been any of the other ports. But Baltimore is sort of a niche port, unless you're in Baltimore. Those folks I feel badly for, not to mention their traffic nightmares that they're living through now.
Of course, coming down the pipeline later in the year as well, we've got the end of the ILA dock workers deal on that East Coast as well, end of September, that is. Gav, do we know when the Dali is going to be cleared and access the port reopened, or is it too early to say?
Oh, it's way too early to say. In fact, with every passing day, I think it becomes more uncertain. There was the US Army Corps of Engineers released some sonar readings that they'd taken of the riverbed, I think from the last day or so. And it shows how sections of the bridges, you know, the welding, the various steel line girders have now become, they've sunk into the mud. And I tell you, if it's one of those seabeds, and we have this on the east coast of the UK, where you have a very muddy seabed, things get submerged, they get sucked in, they effectively start acting like anchors. So it becomes incredibly difficult to remove them from the seabed. And until you've removed them from the seabed, you really can't open the port up again. So it's, yeah, you know, you can look at the present pictures of it. You've got the ship is exactly where it is when it first struck the bridge, right? Except that it's got a section of road across its bow. They've started taking some of the top containers off the stacks nearest to the bow, which will then allow them to start cutting away the debris that's on top of the ship. But that still doesn't, you're not going to be able to clear the channel until you can cut the vessel away from the wreckage and tow it to a nearby dock. And yeah, it's, you know, really, this is a very open-ended question at the moment. It's one of those ones where each time you dig in a little bit more, you discover things are slightly worse than you'd hope for.
Yeah, it's going to be tough for everybody in that region for the foreseeable then. Let's look then at the blame game, as one Loadstar story branded it. This is something we're all familiar with whenever we have a container shipping incident. And a lot of people from maybe outside the industry struggle to get their heads around things like general average, which to simplify is a legal principle in maritime law under which all stakeholders, ship owners, carriers, cargo owners, proportionately share the losses caused by a voluntary sacrifice of part of a ship or cargo to save the whole in an emergency. And just to lose you all on some more of the language out there, In the US, we also have in play the Limitation of Liability Act of 1851, which was passed to protect the maritime industry from events beyond its control, such as storms and pirates. These are all going to be appearing in the mainstream news, by the way. So you're hearing it here first, possibly, or maybe not. All of it sounds rather ancient and outdated, mainly because most of them are really, really old. Gav, as we're speaking in the second week of April, general average, it hasn't been called, which I'm sure is a relief for those with cargo on board. When do you think we'll get any sort of view about who will be paying for all this when we're talking about estimated costs of $2 to $4 billion?
It's a big question, isn't it? Okay, so the owner have gone to, I can't remember which jurisdiction it is, but one of the US courts, and filed to limit their liability on the vessel, i.e. what they would be able to pay out on it. They've limited that to $43.6 million, which they say is, they value the vessel at $90 million. You take away 43.6 and you're left with what they say is going to be the cost of the salvage and the repairs, basically. As far as general average goes, it is my understanding that general average can't be declared until the vessel has been tied up alongside. So
I think that's true.
To go back to my previous answer, because we still don't know when the vessel is going to be freed from the site, it won't be able to be called until it's freed from the site and pulled up alongside. And I mean, I think it's probably the industry. We've just had one of these, right? We've just had the Ever Given. You just go back to the Ever Given. It's all the same sort of stuff. It just took place in a different part of the world and under slightly different circumstances. But my recollection of the Ever Given is that it was general average was only called once the vessel had been refloated and towed up to an anchorage point, the northern end of Suez. And then as soon as it was, they declared general average. And I would expect you're probably going to see a broadly similar sequence of events in this case.
Yeah, I mean, just for anyone who's not familiar with the Ever Given incident, that was March 2021. It blocked the Suez Canal for 6 days and caused absolute global chaos. And general average was called then. One of the things that came out then and is going to come out again in Baltimore or is already, is that a lot of shippers think they're covered or insured for maritime incidents, either by their forwarder or under more general business insurance. Many also just refuse to take out insurance because shipping's safe and reliable. Steph, have you got any views on or knowledge of why this is? It seems bizarre when you explain it to people, when you see what the potential repercussions are if you get called under general average for your business.
Right. It's a lack of education, a lack of knowledge. There's a lot of assumptions. I think that shippers assume they're covered under their standard insurance policies, but it's really a lack of understanding about the industry and, you know, just international logistics in general, and most importantly, maritime law, which is very, very old. And if you understood the industry, like I think we all do, there's some understanding why it is written that way. But the tiny amount of liability that the actual vessel owners and the carriers that they have, my experience in the forwarding years I've been here, we make it a priority that our salespeople sell insurance, if not to actually get it for ourselves, to at least educate the customer that they have to have maritime insurance. It is a separate and absolutely integral thing that they must have if they're shipping internationally.
Steph, there's a few things like in the press that caught my eye. As shocked editorials in the US about foreign companies damaging infrastructure. I got a one press release from a US maritime linked union saying essentially this wouldn't have happened with US crew, even though there's no suggestion at this stage that the Indian crew on the vessel were in any way to blame. There's been companies and organizations sort of trying to profit from this or by commentating on the industry in a way that's not really appropriate. Some of them are trying to score political points. I found it quite shameful in some ways. What's your view on how this is being covered in the US? Don't people understand supply chains and shipping after COVID?
You would think, right? I mean, I look at this, unfortunately, sadly to me, this is just like much of what or how the media covers just about anything in our country now. They focus on the extremes or even the conspiratory angle because, you know, facts don't sell. Views do. And hysteria drives views. So this is just the MO in the US media now. And it's, some of it's from the political side and the dissension and the complete division that we have politically in this country. But our media has become no longer really very fact-driven. They're really just, how can we spin it in a way that makes it look a little bit more fearful? Or, you know, we do the same thing with weather. Drives me nuts.
With weather. Well, is that some people moving to centigrade? Is that how that works?
Maybe.
Centigrade and Fahrenheit gone red and blue.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I just, the US is not the only, or not the only place where there's political division, that's for sure.
Oh, Gav, yeah.
Sorry, did you want to say something?
No, I just wanted to sort of point out that it's a general law of seamanship that if there's an obstacle in a navigation channel, it is going to get hit. I mean, they always do. Everything gets hit. It always does. That's a fundamental rule. And so with that in mind, the one thing I was sort of very surprised about was just the lack of protection that was afforded the bridge.
Absolutely.
Very parochial of me, but we have a bridge here upriver from Felixstowe. It will be Orwell Crossing. And it was built around the same time as the bridge in Baltimore. It was made of concrete, but at the base of its legs are sort of 20 to 30 meters of groins that completely surround the base of the legs. So if a ship is going to hit the legs, it grounds out first.
Right, right.
And I don't understand. We were looking at the Baltimore thing. We were just, because there are 20 to 30 ships passing underneath it every day.
Every day.
That they collided would have had exactly the same effect. And yet, you know, in the 40 plus years that this bridge has been open to traffic, it's never once had its legs reinforced.
Right. I know. It's crazy. You know, sadly, we just, number one, I don't think there's enough. Obviously, you're right. Over the last several decades, you think somebody would have said, you know, boats can't stop on a dime. Yeah. Like a car.
But if we dump some rocks there, they will.
It will be built very differently when it is put back together. That is for sure.
Sure. Do you think other sort of infrastructure across the country might be like re-looked at again as a result of this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, we are in the middle of our giant infrastructure bill that was passed last year. So there's certainly money floating around all over the country. And I have no doubt that bridges, you know, there was a bridge that collapsed just because of in Minneapolis several, you know, I think a decade ago or something like that, that was just, you know, lack of maintenance. So bridges are a big topic in the United States.
Well, you wouldn't want to have turned down a bill to upgrade the safety on a bridge if this happens again. So I guess there'll be a political will behind this now if people can find the budget. Container rates. So, Steph, we had that Suez-inspired spot rally this year, followed by, from February pretty much, many weeks of declines. On the Trans-Pacific trade, this is particularly relevant as shippers and carriers are shadow boxing on these annual Trans-Pacific rates. Does Baltimore change this conversation in any way, either on routing or the tightness of the market or that all-important contract freight spread?
Yeah, we're not really seeing that. I mean, no. Of course, if your main port of call is Baltimore, then certainly it's a major impact for you. But overall, most of the negotiations or maybe lack thereof, it really are being driven by the spot market and the spread between what the carriers are wanting to offer in new rates and what the shippers really think is appropriate and what they want, especially on the IPIs. That's really where the biggest, I think, dissension is right now, causing people to really slow walk the negotiations. And the carriers so far, what I'm hearing and certainly what we're experiencing is the carriers are not budging yet, but there's 20 days left to go. So
they're not budging from where they were 2 months ago or where spot rates are now in comparison to those long-term contracts.
Well, I mean, long-term rates are always lower than spot rates, of course. They've come down a little bit, but not. I always play a game with myself. 6 months ago, I decided where I thought the West Coast rate was going to land. I've talked to several of my colleagues and mentors, and we were pretty much in alignment where we thought the West Coast rate would be. And they're not there quite yet. And like you said, the bigger issue is the IPI points. You know, you used to be able to lay your contracts out across your desk, and everybody's rates would pretty much align with each other, making it very simple for NVOs especially to do blended rates and be able to pick and choose who we want to give the freight to. But IPIs sometimes get a little bit squirrely, and certainly that tells you where a carrier wants cargo or they don't want cargo. But this year, there's an expectation that that could be even more dramatic. Even people that, you know, even a Chicago may see rates being very different, which is quite problematic for NVOs.
When are we expecting a lot of people to sign these contracts then? It's been dragging on.
I think it's going to come down to the wire. And as much as I know the carriers don't want to extend these contracts, I wouldn't be surprised if they dribbled into early May, because there's not a lot of movement that I'm hearing from what either, especially the large BCOs. None of the large BCOs have signed yet. That is, at least that's bled out into the industry. And usually that happens very quickly. I mean, I usually get a call the same day when Walmart signs and then the numbers come out. But it's pretty quiet right now.
Wait and see. Let's wait and see. Gav, where's spot markets going elsewhere then? They're on a similar sort of pattern, isn't it?
Similar. I think you asked me a couple of days ago, Mike, and said, like, is this the market? Freight rates went up after the Red Sea crisis. It should also be remembered that that was in the context of the pre-Chinese New Year surge. So having those two things combined, they're often put down that rates went up because of the Red Sea thing, but it actually came at the same time as pre-Chinese New Year. So now that Chinese New Year is over, rates have started dropping down slightly. So are we now able to discern the actual impact of the Red Sea crisis without the added complication of having a pre-Chinese New Year surge? And then you ask me, is this a normalization of the freight rate market, to which prompted basically an existential crisis, because I just couldn't. I had real problems with the word normalization.
Me too, but I like putting them in your court.
When normalization and freight markets in the same sentence just doesn't go together.
Right. I mean, or who is normal? Who's normal, right? The carriers exactly. Want normal to be the pandemic, which is not normal.
Which is not normal. Everything's gone out. So it's almost like it's a complex economic ecosystem that constantly morphs due to the millions of inputs that it has going into at any given point. So like asking if it's normalized is a bit like asking, has evolution finished?
Do you know what? If I put into the Lodestar archive normalized container and freight market, I bet I'll find a few stories.
Undoubtedly. Don't listen to what I say, only what I write.
I mean, the one thing I would say about normalization and why I think there is still such dissension between the carriers and the shippers right now, with negotiations being, which, you know, we should be at a point where people are signing, is there has been a bit of a normalization around the Suez Canal. The fact that we are not shipping there anymore and that we're all having to deal with going around the Cape of Good Hope, that has normalized. There's not, you know, the carriers had plenty of vessels to add the capacity into that lane, and that's part of why the shippers are angry.
That was my reference to normalization as well. Have liner networks normalized around these ongoing disruptions?
Yep.
That's
they have.
But Gav, what are we seeing on the numbers?
Sorry, numbers. Yeah, of course. Okay. So look, I'll just get, here's a little compare and contrast from you. This is all derived from Senator. It's XSI. So it's basically what they call average short-term market rates, which is, I mean, a shorthand for spot rates, right? Effectively,
yeah.
With a bit of short-term contract stuff put in. Right. They hit a high. So Asia North Europe high of $4,859 per 40 foot. Now, that was on the 22nd of January. So that's what I was just talking about. That's classic Red Sea crisis combined with pre-Chinese New Year rush. The latest reading, which is from the 4th of April, has that rate down 31% to $3,334 per 40 foot. So, and actually, it's pretty similar on the Trans-Pacific as well. Steph will have a much better view of that than me, but it was $4,777 was the 22nd of February. That was its height. And latest reading, it's down 27% to $3,481. So really, pretty broadly similar performances from the two main East-West trades.
Well, while we're on the subject of normalization, what do either of you think about how the current normal will evolve if the Houthis, as they're threatening to do, expand their range of attack into the Arabian Sea? Now, we don't know if this is going to happen, but there's plenty of stories out there, so I feel compelled to ask you about it.
I mean, disruption is never good. You know, disruption is never good for shippers. It has a financial impact that is usually positive for carriers and forwarders, because that, you know, gives us a value-added proposition. It props up rates. But obviously, it would be devastating for the global economy. This would not be good. We don't want any more disruptions.
Okay, well, of course, these diversions away from Suez around the Cape of Good Hope are, of course, impacting air cargo markets. So let's turn now to Neil van der Wouw, Zenit's Chief Air Freight Officer. Hey, Neil, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Mike. Good afternoon to you, and thank you for inviting me again.
You're always welcome. I was particularly drawn by some of your comments, actually. So the air cargo market post-Lunar New Year, you called it surprisingly resilient after we saw an 11% increase in demand in March. That was a third consecutive month of gains. So I guess the question really is, why were you surprised?
Well, I think I wasn't the only one who was surprised. If you would have asked people October last year, you know, what is your outlook for Q1? I don't think we would have gotten many people who had said, well, I expected demand increase double digit year over year. So it's surprising. And I've met several people throughout the value chain, and nobody really can get their hand on it. I mean, yes, Red Sea, yes, e-commerce, but there's more to it than that. And it seems that even the, I think the global economy sometimes defies, let's say, well, many experts and scientists have said things need to calm down, but it just keeps on humming along, it seems. Maybe that's why it's surprising.
We've had some big year-on-year gains on the ocean freight market. Now, it's hard to tell exactly what that means in March, but is this just a reflection of where maybe the economy's bouncing back a bit quicker, or have you been able to identify how much of this is e-commerce, or is that localized, or how much of this is a Red Sea in crisis type story?
Well, e-commerce is definitely localized, although it spreads, let's say it wings over the rest of the world, but the origin are very distinct, southern China, Hong Kong, predominantly. And the Red Sea situation, yeah, that's affecting predominantly Middle East, Indian subcontinent, and Asia into Europe.
We've seen this big shift because of the Red Sea to sea air solutions. Where are we seeing that in terms of numbers? Which airports are really benefiting from this?
What I've seen is that India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, rates have gone through the roof. In some cases, doubled compared to earlier on this year. And although it's always difficult to exactly match anecdotes and data, but I've been hearing a lot of stories about apparel companies not taking the risk and getting perhaps their apparel in time for the Western spring into the shops on the shelves and not wanting to run the risk of moving that by ocean.
Are we seeing any change in terms of capacity? Is anything coming into the market maybe to take advantage of some of these trends?
No, not to that extent. But we'll see a lot of capacity coming into the market from now going forward because of the summer schedule of the passenger airlines. So that should provide some relief in some of these markets.
Can you give us a more of an indication? If you say looking at the Asia into Europe market, what's been going on in the rates? So if you look at that 3-month period that we've just been discussing.
Yeah, there's been upward pressure on that. And the interesting bit is that initially when the Red Sea crisis started, you know, we had many journalists reaching out to us. Hey, do you see rates increasing? And we said, no, we don't see that just yet. We initially saw volumes increase, but not so much the rates. But as of late, yeah, we've seen it increasing. And because demand grew 11% year over year, supply just by 6. So that went up. And yeah, and the continuous disruption in the Red Sea plays a big part of that.
And same on the Trans-Pacific, similar trends and drivers in that market?
No, it's different. Of course, the Red Sea is not affecting that market. And yeah, what do you see typically? It could be up to 30% increase in capacity in the next few weeks, months, because of the summer schedules I just mentioned. So that will definitely either make the markets a bit easier or put a downward pressure on rates because of that influx. I'd be very surprised if demand will be able to pick up just as much as we'll see the increase in capacity.
Are we seeing any of those US carriers coming back into that US-China market?
That's still pretty slow. Yeah, that's by no means do we see the recovery. I don't have the exact numbers yet, but we do not see the same recovery as we've seen, let's say, in the Western part of the world to and from China just yet.
And the forward outlook, if volume growth surprised you through Q1, when some people would, as you say, were expecting a drop-off, what are you expecting to happen later in the year? More surprises for you, Neil?
Well, the air freight is known to throw curveballs. I mean, that's maybe also the existence, its existence, to be able to deal when things get a bit messy. I think a big question mark for many shippers that are now entering longer term agreements with freight forwarders, what's a Q4 going to look like with it? Will we see a similar kind of boost from the e-commerce behemoths? That's what really happened in Q4 out of certain markets. So what I think it's going to be busy. I had my own question marks on the companies like Shein. Hey, call me naive to think, my God, how can they make that work? But apparently they made $2 billion profit US dollars in 2023. So if that's the case, and I have to take that at face value, they're not going to go away. And if you can make so much money, others will try to take a piece of the pie as well. So I think they will only become bigger and bigger.
Thanks for joining us today on the Loadstar podcast, Neil.
You're welcome, Mike. You have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Steph, back on the Americas, if we may. I have been interviewing quite a few people this year, and they're saying that people are shipping early. And we've just had some data out from Descartes as well, and we've got a 15.7% jump in March volumes year on year now. There's not apples and slightly apples and pears comparison because it's not exactly the same this year to last year and the Lunar New Year was different, etc. But are we seeing people shipping early and what does this mean for the peak season?
Yeah, I do think there are a lot of dynamics right now driving this and there will be a likelihood of an early peak season for sure. I mean, you've got longer transit times around Africa. You've got just the general need for restocking, which is great for the industry. You've got the Baltimore blow to the East Coast. You've got the continual Panama Canal drought and obviously the ILA labor situation. And I do think there is a big fear of the possibility that Trump could win and that he would put these giant tariffs in place that would be disastrous.
Those tariffs, just for anyone listening, what we know so far, we've got this threat of a universal 10% import tariff and 60% plus on imports into the US from China. So, I mean, the elections are in November. If you're signing a one-year contract now, this is in play, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, it might mean lower MQCs. It might mean different declining allocations toward the end of the year. I mean, a tariff that high is so extreme and would dramatically curtail, if not stop, certain imports, certainly a lot of consumer goods, especially low-value consumer goods, being imported from China at all. Or it would The only other choice would be to dramatically increase the purchase price for the consumer, which could drive inflation, which could drive recession. It's a very scary thought.
Have you looked at like plan Bs for customers if this does happen? Are we at that stage yet or is it still too early?
Well, I mean, we've been seeing people divert away from China, whether it's completely, most of them, it's the whole China plus one idea, right? That after the pandemic, no one should put all their eggs in one basket. So some of these shippers have already got suppliers and, potential partners in other countries in Southeast Asia. We're seeing a shift to Latin America. So, I mean, there's certainly for some companies, they've got a plan B, but not everyone. And again, I think the bigger impact is that low value consumer kind of commodities that are, it takes money to find a new supplier. It takes time to find a new supplier. And Vietnam is not China. They're not as big. They're not as structured. They don't have the same number of employee base. So I think this could be a real significant impact to the industry should it happen.
We've had this threat from former President Trump about imports of Chinese-made cars from Mexico. So Mexico obviously was one of the places that was attracting so much foreign direct investment, a lot of it from China. If it's China plus one, but the plus one can't involve a Chinese company, that changes the game again, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Exactly. I mean, Mexico is now our largest trading partner, and a lot of that was because of that push out of China. But you're right, we're buying Chinese goods that are made in Mexico. That's not going to work.
Okay, let's pivot slightly. Another big story in the States is, of course, detention and demurrage, and a lot of this goes back to the COVID period. We've got a lot of ongoing cases before the Federal Maritime Commission with lines looking at some big fines. The latest of these is a recommended US $63 million fine for MSC for alleged violations of the Shipping Act. This involves several customers. FMC's Office of Enforcement says the carrier undertook unreasonable and unfair practices that did not facilitate or, and I quote, ensure an efficient, competitive and economical transportation system in the ocean commerce of the United States. Gav, now I am far, far too modest to mention that this podcast was cited in one filing by Samsung due to an excellent and exclusive interview with FMC Chairman Daniel Maffei. But if you have to run through this story and some of these other cases, you do so and I'll hide my considerable blushes.
Yes. Mike, I've got no shame in pimping you out, especially since you so exhaustively pointed me to the documents and exactly which footnote I could find said citation in. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, it was. So Samsung is suing Costco and 00CL over DMD, unlawful DMD charges. I mean, you know, this isn't exactly a new story in its thing. But yes, it was an interview that you conducted with Daniel Maffei. And yes, the podcast cited in a couple of points. I mean, effectively, Samsung has noted that Costco had faced a number of other complaints by shippers for similar behavior, and the consistency in the allegations across the complaints highlights that Costco's conduct with respect to detention demurrage charges was part of a broader unreasonable practice and policy. I mean, there were a lot of charges. Samsung paid 22,000 separate detention and demurrage charges over the, from 2020, and 5,000 of those were for rail storage. I mean, okay, Samsung is a big shipper, but I would have thought this is going to be a hefty bill laid at Costco's door should it be found to be guilty of this.
Yeah, I would think so. And we've also got Flexport has filed a $12.3 million lawsuit against customer Giti Tires. Yeah, yes. Claiming it refused to pay an extensive list of detention fees. I think we've got these cases are going to come on and on. Steph, are you dealing with any of this?
Not directly, because again, you know, our volumes here are relatively small. I mean, we had customers face this. And to me, this is an existential problem going back to the fact that the process that we've allowed the carriers to pass detention and demurrage charges onto the public, whether that be the truckers, a forwarder, their importer, has been horrible and needed updating for a very long time. And during the pandemic, obviously, it exploded without, you know, and understandably so, given what was going on. But so on the one hand, you have the carriers who we all know made absolute insanity amounts of money during the pandemic, and everybody knows it because it was published in the media constantly. So you have this, you know, group of carriers that have all this money. So of course the importers who are being impacted by situations that I had said early on in the pandemic, the smartest thing the carriers could have done during the pandemic was to say we will not charge excessive detention and demurrage charges because this is completely out of everybody's control. And they should have negotiated with the terminals and found some way to mint, because we all know what they charge the customer or what they charge the forwarder is a massive upcharge to what they're actually paying to the terminals. So this was a long time coming that there would be this kind of explosion revolving around these charges. I think the FMC and the shippers want to make sure going forward, should this happen again, this has to be handled differently. Carriers cannot make that much money on the backs of shippers for things that they cannot control. That's not fair.
Before we move on, a big shout out to Christopher Nolan, a partner at Holland and Knight representing Samsung Electronics America, for letting us know about this podcast's first reference in a legal pleading. And good luck with the case, Chris. Steph, I can't let you go without discussing changes in the Container Shipping Alliance system. In particular, we have the end of 2M between Maersk and MSC in early 2025, followed by the setting up by Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd of Gemini Cooperation in February. Gemini is promising 90% schedule reliability by implementing a global hub and spoke system. So I have two questions. One, do you think this reliability promise is something the market wants and will pay for? And two, is it achievable? Or put it another way, are you a fan of hub and spoke shipping logistics systems? Because we've all seen these before, haven't we?
Correct. No doubt everyone wants to see improvement in service levels. That's a given, especially those looking to once again get back to, you know, just in time, definitely would pay for it. But I think there's a lot of trepidation and, you know, skepticism about the hub and spoke plan. because really what that is it's another way of saying transshipments. And nobody likes transshipments. Nobody. So there's a lot that is riding on this for Hapag and Maersk, for sure. They are both two carriers that, as different as they are in some ways, are very similar in that service has always been their number one push. So if they can pull it off, they could change the landscape of how we ship ocean containers. But there's a lot riding on that. And they clearly, the transshipment plan is that the ships will be significantly bigger. They will move more than once a week. But, you know, nobody likes transshipments because everybody has been in that situation where their can gets left behind and nobody likes that. So a lot to be seen here.
Well, that brings me finally and very, very nicely and smoothly to Edward Gibbon, Gav. He's the famous historian who wrote about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Now, when we both started out in this industry many years ago, a common theme for us journos was which container port was the biggest, the top 100 container port. I think Gav wrote the encyclopedia on that.
I did.
Hong Kong was always part of the equation, but it's slipping away somewhat, isn't it? Is this all about Gemini placing its calls elsewhere, or is there more to this decline, Gav?
So basically, Hong Kong was the world's largest container terminal for some time, right? For a number of years until it was overtaken by Singapore. And that was that Hong Kong-Singapore rivalry. And then in the sort of mid-2000s, Singapore was overtaken by Shanghai because that's where the cargo is. Nowadays, if you look at Hong Kong and its inclusion as a direct port of call on three alliances, it's completely absent from the Gemini prospectus. It's not even nominated as a spoke port. If you do a control F find on the Gemini prospectus, you won't find a single reference to Hong Kong at all. So that sort of says its own little thing, I think. The ocean alliance, number of calls on the ocean lines have halved over the last year. And on the alliances, they recently published their Trans-Pacific schedule. It's just one call out of about 8 or 9 services. So it has fallen way down the rankings. And, you know, it's twice the price to handle a container in Hong Kong as it is in Yantian, Nansha or Dachen Bay or River. It's further away from the cargo. It just doesn't have the offer that the southern Chinese ports have anymore. It's probably worth remembering that, you know, Hong Kong's heyday was before that whole industrial belt had been built up, that belt that goes from Guangzhou all the way to Shenzhen. A lot of that's farmland when Hong Kong was the world's largest container port, right? And if you look at how that's developed in the intervening years, with their own dedicated port facilities. I mean, it was always hard to see how Hong Kong would remain competitive in the future.
Yeah. Do you have any of your customers, Steph, pushing for Hong Kong for any reason? Or is that ship sailed, so to speak?
Yeah, I can't remember the last time someone asked for Hong Kong. I mean, we see Shenzhen, we see Yantian, Hong Kong is an air freight. It's sort of like the difference between Beijing and Zhangjiang. Or Tianjin, whichever port you want to use. It's Hong Kong will be in air freight. We'll use Hong Kong only for air freight someday.
Yeah, air freight and nice residential places. I reckon those the Kuching container terminals, really well located, very beautiful. You know, that'll be redone into hotels or whatever. The trouble is, it's very emotive for a lot of people in our industry because so many people have spent large parts of their career there. During a time when it was a really exciting place to be, you know, it's a really easy place for, especially if you're a European or Western, and you go to Hong Kong, you really feel like you're in Asia, you know, neon lights and humid temperatures and 24-hour street.
Hong Kong foreign correspondent bar.
Exactly, mate. From the FCC, what a place. You know, so for a lot of people, there's quite an emotive thing about seeing the decline of what for many people is their favorite Asian city.
Yeah, I would say that's true for me. I think we have to finish there, but I've really enjoyed your time. Stephanie Loomis, Head of Ocean Freight for North America at Rhenus Logistics, and Gavin Van Maal, Managing Editor of The Lodestar. Thanks for joining me today on The Lodestar Podcast.
Thanks, Mike. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Big thanks to my editing team, Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And most of all, gratitude to you all for listening. We'll be back soon.